This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Sushi has made quite a transformation. Once an exotic and delicate stranger, sushi is now something we think we know very well. It seems to be everywhere, from university cafeterias to your grocer's freezer to trendy downtown restaurants. But how much do we really know about sushi? Where does it come from? Who fishes it? And how does a fish caught on the other side of the world end up artfully arranged on my plate, uncooked, just days later? We'll be speaking with two sushi experts in a minute, but first, are you a sushi enthusiast, and do you have a question for our guests? If you just can't get over the notion of eating raw fish, what would get you to try sushi? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our first guest is Sasha Issenberg, author of The Sushi Economy, Globalization, and the Making of a Modern Delicacy. He joins us from member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Sasha Issenberg, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Rebecca.
Your book sort of looks at sushi as an example of globalization. How did you become interested in the topic? Was it the economy or the fish that interested you first?
Well, it was the fish. I mean, at some point I'd realized that I thought I was fairly knowledgeable about sushi because if I went to eat it at a restaurant, I knew the Japanese names for each of the 10 things on my plate. And at some point, I was struck that I didn't know which ocean any of them had come from, and I didn't know how long they'd been out of the water, and I didn't know whose hands they'd passed on their way to me. And when I went to other types of restaurants, all that information was on the menu about my lettuce or my chicken, all sorts of agricultural information.
Right. You could go meet the goat that was milked for your cheese at the, you know,
and you go to a sushi bar still and you order by the species, which is something that we don't do anywhere else. It's this really old-fashioned, it seemed to me, anachronistic way of asking for your food. So with that in mind, I embarked on this sort of, you know, journalistic investigation to find out where the food at my sushi bar was coming from. And what I realized was that it was this sort of vast, new, dynamic global industry that in many ways reflected the character of what we call globalization.
And you focus a lot on the bluefin tuna. Why that fish?
Well, it's the most valuable, the most desired fish in this sort of sushi system. It's a thing that chefs are always usually most focused on, the things that diners demand the most. And what's most interesting about it as a business story is that it's so dynamic in terms of its value. I mean, it can lose more value more quickly than anything else on earth. And there's such a range of quality, even within a single fish. And so the sort of global supply chains and mechanisms that have been created to make sure that cuts of bluefin tuna end up in the right place by dinner time is this incredibly sophisticated tale of a global economy in action.
Explain that a little further. How can you have a range of quality within one fish?
Well, the Japanese have any number of names for the different cuts of meat, which vary in quality and oil content, flavor, texture. And so, you know, Americans are probably familiar with toro, which is a term referring to the sort of oily cuts of tuna belly, which the Japanese actually split up into multiple cuts of toro. And the Japanese have a word akami for the sort of leaner red meat cuts. But the fatty cuts these days in Tokyo regularly sell for three times the lean cuts. So within a whole fish, you have these kind of gradients of quality that end up being priced accordingly as they get closer to a chef.
And is that value placed on the fatty toro a fad? Has that sort of which part of the tuna is popular comes and goes?
It's a fad. It's a generation-long one. The sort of Japanese national food culture preferred lean fish until well into the 20th century. So during the 19th century, tuna was one of the least valued of fishes for sushi and otherwise. And frequently, the fatty cuts were served to cats or marinated sort of beyond recognition because human beings didn't like to eat the oily meat. It was during the post-war period, during the American occupation, when the Japanese, who had never had much of a meat-eating culture, saw their occupiers bringing in these cuts of beef and serving them in greasy red steaks. And it sort of let the Japanese know that oily cuts of red meat were not only edible, um, but what could be seen as a luxury product. And you, in the 50s and especially in the 60s, you see this sort of inversion of value in the fish markets, where previously the leaner fish and leaner cuts of tuna were desired. All of a sudden, you have this sort of tyranny of fat. And for the last generation or so, the Japanese idea of luxury at the sushi bar has very much been associated with fatty pieces of tuna.
So at my average sushi restaurant, you know, step up from the food court, but not the highest of the high end. If I'm eating tuna, is it bluefin, and where is it from?
It could be bluefin, it could be big eye, it could be yellowfin. Those are, in descending order, the three major species of red tuna served for sushi. It depends on where you are, what time of year mostly. We're in the summer months now, so there are bluefin tuna being caught in the Atlantic. And more of those, it used to be that all those fish ended up in Japan, just because there's a huge disparity between what the Japanese market would pay for them and what American chefs would pay. And in the last decade, that shrunk. The Japanese economy has sort of gone through a weak period. Americans are willing to pay more and more for better quality fish. So more good domestically caught bluefin tuna is being served in American restaurants now than was just 10 years ago.
Joining us now is Trevor Corson. He's the author of The Zen of Fish, The Story of Sushi from Samurai to Supermarket. He's here in Studio 3A. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, your book actually takes a focus of some students trying to learn how to be sushi chefs, although there's a lot of common ground in your two books. Do you think there is a trend, before we leave the bluefin altogether, of sushi chefs starting to pay, or sushi restaurants starting to pay more attention to sustainability issues?
Not quite yet, but I'm hoping that we're all going to be pushing them in that direction. I think that sushi chefs are a little behind the curve still on this whole question of, you know, the sourcing of the food and where it's coming from. And Sasha's book is interesting because it shows, you know, what a distant set of relationships a fish has to pass through by the time it gets to the sushi bar. You know, God knows where it's from originally. And so I think that one of the interesting things, and I think consumers are going to have to drive this. People who love to eat sushi but who are concerned about fish stocks are going to be the people who are going to have to go in, you know, establish a relationship with their sushi chef and then educate the chef, you know, as the chef educates them about sushi and the traditions. I think the consumers are going to need to educate chefs about, hey, look, I don't want to eat bluefin tuna because I've been reading in the news about how it's, you know, overfished and that kind of thing. So I think there's going to have to be a little bit of back and forth across the sushi bar on this subject.
Well, I got to say, developing a relationship with your local sushi chef is sort of a daunting prospect. I mean, it seems pretty intimidating.
It's very intimidating. And, you know, you see that stern chef behind the bar.
It doesn't really invite chit-chat.
No, it doesn't. And one of the things that I have been trying to do with my book and with a recent article I wrote in the New York Times op-ed page is to remind people that at its best, the sushi chef position is really supposed to be like a neighborhood bartender. It's a friendly guy who gets to know his customers, chit-chats with them, and recommends things for them to eat. And certainly, my experience of eating sushi in Japan was very much like that. I lived in Japan for 3 years, and it was a very friendly neighborhood kind of atmosphere, and the chef was at the center of this conversation. And one of the Japanese chefs I write about in my book, The Zen of Fish, is one of these chefs. He's a fairly rare commodity in the U.S., but a chef who has managed to, in his own way, get over the language barrier, get over the culture barrier, and really establish a wonderful rapport with his customers. And so my advice to people is go to shop around different sushi chefs until you find one that's like that, and then stay there, keep going to that place, and have a good time, and your sushi experience will get more and more interesting, I suspect, as time goes on.
Let's hear from Aaron in Salem, Oregon. Aaron, welcome to Talk the Nation.
Thank you. My question is, there seems to be so many different types of sushi out there, and for someone who's never really dabbled with sushi much, it can be a bit overwhelming to know where to start. So what's a good place to start for somebody who's just getting into sushi?
Trevor Corson?
Well, I would suggest that you walk into a sushi bar, and as daunting as it seems, don't even, you know, bother sitting at a table or picking up the menu if you can possibly avoid it. Go in, sit at the bar, and sit down in front of the chef and say, I am a complete novice. Tell me what to do. Tell me how to eat sushi. Tell me what I should start with. And you know, you, maybe you'll get lucky and you'll get a chef who right away will be receptive to that. Maybe not. You may have to, again, like I said, shop around a little bit.
Now, I don't want to speak for Aaron, but I would be worried if I did that, that I would end up with a $400 lunch.
Yeah, exactly. Now, that's a big issue, and that's another thing that I've tried to raise with people, is I think that at least in the U.S., sushi chefs and customers need to learn to have a conversation about money for this whole thing to work, because you're exactly right. That is one of the fears. So I really encourage people to say, look, I've got a budget tonight. I want to come in. I want to eat a few things that you would recommend, something special, but I don't want to spend a whole lot of money. What can you do for me? And again, you might have to wait, you know, until you get a chef who's receptive to that, but I think it's something worth trying for.
Sasha Issenberg, what's your advice for a sushi novice?
I mean, I think that the chef is a wonderful resource for people, and for novices and for experienced diners too. Basically connect with the last link in this sort of global supply chain that serves, you know, from the fisherman all the way to the diner as a way of sort of sorting fish and making sure it reaches its sort of optimal endpoint. And what diners have, that option to sort of in the American language, to sort of go in the kitchen and watch your food being made, is in a way to sort of help pick out what you're going to be served. And the more engaged you are with a chef, the more one's meal will sort of be crafted to individual, you know, desires or needs. And that's something that's open to everybody who goes into a sushi bar.
Trevor Corson, you talk some in your book about how the sort of original Japanese chefs who brought sushi to America didn't think that we could handle it, basically, at least didn't think we could handle the odder fish or the stranger tastes, and sort of made this maguro and salmon diet because they thought that's all we could take.
Well, right. I mean, I think when I was doing my research for this book in L.A., I spent a lot of time in L.A. hanging out with people in the sushi world there and talking with them. And one of the impressions that came through was that, yeah, you know, a lot of the early Japanese chefs, it in a way kind of looked down at American customers and didn't necessarily make the effort to educate us in all those things.
We're talking about sushi this hour. Here's a tip for you. Don't rub your wooden chopsticks together to get the splinters off. In fact, don't use your chopsticks at all. Eat the sushi with your fingers. More tips coming up. I'm Rebecca Roberts. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington, filling in for Neil Conan. The sushi bar is the place to be, and we're taking you on a tour of one of the fishiest cuisines. Here's another tip for you. When you're dipping your sushi in soy sauce, dip the fish side. It's less likely to fall apart. Any other tips or suggestions? Give us a call, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And check out our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. We're talking with Sasha Issenberg. He's the author of The Sushi Economy, Globalization and the Making of a Modern Delicacy. And Trevor Corson, author of The Zen of Fish. Again, the number to join us, 1-800-989-TALK. Actually, you know, while we're on the subject of tips, I found not only did I learn about the chopstick thing and the dip the fish side, not the rice side, I also, you know, I do all sorts of rude things. I'd put wasabi in my soy sauce. And what I sort of want to know is that the rudeness equivalent of, say, putting your elbows on the table, which is frowned upon but isn't really going to make people shield their eyes in horror? Or am I, you know, scratching myself at the sushi bar?
It's more like putting ketchup on a really nice steak. It's not so much about the etiquette per se, and I'm the last person to want to be the sushi police, you know, and tell people exactly how they have to act at the sushi bar. All of those tips are tips that have to do with allowing you to enjoy the experience of eating this stuff more fully and to have a better relationship with the chef. So, you know, I can't tell you how many chefs I talk to, they roll their eyes and they say, well, I don't even know why I bother, you know, trying to get the best fish because most of my customers put all this soy sauce and wasabi on it. And, you know, to be honest, they're really not tasting the fish. And we don't know any better. You know, I mean, we all do this. We all put all the wasabi and soy sauce. And in Japan, Or even here, a really good sushi chef will tell you, no soy sauce, no wasabi. He'll put a tiny bit of wasabi inside the sushi when he makes it, just the right amount, depending on the type of fish he's using. And that's really all there should be. And he may even season each piece of sushi differently with a special little sauce that he's concocted that may include some soy sauce, maybe something else. But the regular soy sauce that we get, you know, at sushi restaurants, as a matter of course, is really too strong for the delicate flavors of most fish. And in the book, I talk about this whole science of fish flesh and why the flavors are the way they are, and it's a very delicate business. So,
wasabi, too, is not... I mean, the green paste we get at American restaurants should be wasabi in quotation marks.
Right, wasabi in quotation marks. There's almost no real wasabi anywhere. Real wasabi is a very unique and unusual plant that has a quite different taste. That what we normally get is just horseradish that's been mashed up and stuck with green food coloring and other additives. And that's what we're getting as wasabi. And it really is overpowering on the taste buds. Real wasabi, if you ever get the chance to try it, if you're at a good sushi bar that has it, do, because it is a very different experience. It's a sweeter, kinder, gentler spiciness.
Let's hear from Jason in Portland, Oregon. Jason, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Rebecca. I'm glad you guys are discussing this today. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, welcome.
My girlfriend and I, we've been longtime lovers of sushi, and whenever we'd go to the sushi bar, it would get to the point where we would drop $50, $60, even $70 on a meal because it can be rather expensive. So what we decided to do was find a local market, and we found a local Asian market where we could go and get sushi-grade fish and do it ourselves. And so the first time we did it, it was a little odd because it's a matter of cutting up that raw fish and trusting yourself and how you're doing it. But, you know, once you get past that initial setup, yeah, we literally we got twice the amount of fish for half the money. And it's something like that to where you say it really opens up your eyes and you can try a whole bunch of different things that you wouldn't normally try based on price, if that's the issue.
Jason, thanks for your call. Sasha Isenberg, is Jason spoiled being in Portland and on the Pacific Rim, or are there sushi markets other places in the country?
Well, usually the fish that's going into retail markets is coming through different channels and supply chains and stuff that's going to your better sushi bars. I mean, the first thing I would say is that a term that he used, sushi grade, is a sort of lovely fiction, but doesn't really mean anything. Sushi grade tends to be a word that people who don't serve sushi put on menus to try to sell you mediocre fish on top of salads.
Because it connotes fresh?
It just doesn't really mean anything. I mean, there's no centralized, there's no USDA grading.
Right, but
if a
menu writer is using it, what sort of feel do you think that conveys?
I think it's supposed to mean a quality that, uh-huh. that you would discern if a fish is undercooked. You know, I mean, you often see it in terms of, you know, sushi grade ahi tuna on a salad or something like that, a steak. I mean, it's a meaningless term. So, but by and large, you know, the fish that are – depends where your retail market is or who it's serving. But for a lot of species, it's different fish than you would be getting at a sushi bar. I wouldn't advise people against making sushi at home, but the idea that it's a facsimile of the type of ingredients that you would get going into a restaurant isn't really true.
And Sasha, we have an email for you. This is from Samuel in Denver, who says, are any sushi fish aquacultured?
Yeah, a good number of them. Tuna are ranched, which is different than traditional aquaculture, which is farming, which means breeding or cultivating them fully in captivity. Salmon, which you eat at the sushi bar, is a lot of the yellowfin, yellowtail fish, the hamachi, are being farmed in Japan and now in Hawaii. Red snapper, a lot of smaller fish are being farmed in Japan.
And how is ranching different?
Ranching means catching fish live in the wild and dragging them into pens offshore where they can be sort of fattened and harvested on schedule, as opposed to breeding them entirely in captivity. Tuna basically are too smart and too tough and too unwilling to eat pellets to lend themselves to being raised in pens. And there's a laboratory I visited in Japan that sort of mastered the science of finally of growing out these tuna in under those conditions, but the economics still don't work just because it's too expensive to breed tuna that way. And so tuna are still sort of, you know, immune to full-on farming, but on some days, probably, if you're getting an assortment of 10 pieces of fish at a sushi bar, over half of them could have been farmed.
Let's hear from Peter in San Francisco. Peter, welcome to Talk of the Nation. Peter, are you there?
Oh, yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm afraid I'm going to spoil everybody's appetite. I used to live in Manhattan back in the 80s, and I remember the New York Times health columnist ran an article about all the nasty diseases and parasites you can get from sushi. And there was this urban legend that business really fell in all the sushi restaurants. But obviously, it's revived. So can the guests talk about health concerns, especially with what's happening with the food chain now? And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thank you so much. Trevor Corson?
Oh, that's a great question. And I got to tell you, there are some gripping passages in my book about parasites.
I'll second that, actually. I didn't think that I could describe parasites as gripping, but I found myself riveted.
I had a lot of fun learning about parasites. They're really fascinating. And in fact, there's this museum in Tokyo, the Tokyo Parasitological Museum, where they have a tapeworm that someone got from eating trout sushi that's 30 feet long. So, you know, we got nothing in New York. But, you know, I talk about this at length in the book, the whole question of parasites and the health of eating raw fish, healthfulness of eating raw fish and all that. And it's really, really interesting because it turns out that a lot of this of a well-trained sushi chef skills, that skill set of a traditional sushi chef, actually, you know, go back to before the age of refrigeration, when a lot of these fish had to be prepared in a way where, you know, we didn't have the luxury of keeping them cold and super fresh and all that. And so take a very typical sushi fish like mackerel is a great example. This is actually a fish that is pretty susceptible to parasites, but it's by far historically the most widespread fish used in sushi throughout Japan. And what sushi chefs generally do to mackerel is they pickle it slightly, salt and vinegar. And sushi shops in the old days were even referred to as tsukeba, which means pickling places, because they did so much of this kind of pickling. And so part of the whole point of that was to kill parasites and control bacteria. And there are, believe it or not, sort of hardcore aficionados of sushi to this day who hold that if the fish is just plain old raw, you know, served fresh and raw, it's not actually sushi. The chef has to actually do something to the fish to prevent the problems you might have from parasites and bacteria. But also the flip side of that, very briefly, is that doing those things like pickling a fish allows the fish to age very nicely, which actually is necessary to create flavor. So you don't actually want to be eating a super fresh cut of fish. You want the chef to have sort of aged it slightly for the muscle proteins and stuff to break down into those flavor components that are so tasty. So mackerel is a great example of this. If it's pickled slightly, left to sit for a little while, and then you eat it, it's got a wonderful salty, tart, very flavorful set of flavors going on there. And salmon are very susceptible to parasites, but almost all salmon that we eat now has been deep frozen at a very significant temperature long enough to kill all those parasites.
Is there concern among the higher-end chefs that the spread of sushi will lead to some people not being so careful and some people are going to get sick, and that's going to plunge the popularity of sushi?
Well, absolutely. And that's exactly the reason that the Japanese chef, this well-known chef, Toshi Sugiura in L.A., who's one of the characters in my book, that's exactly the reason that he founded the sushi school in Los Angeles, where my book takes place. I follow a number of American students through their training, their grueling training to become sushi chefs.
Grueling in 3 months as opposed to the 10 years it takes in Japan.
Yeah, they're trying to pack it all in. And a lot of people question, how can you train a sushi chef in 3 months? But his philosophy was that he basically saw the incredible demand for sushi in this country and knew that there was no way the demand was going to be satisfied by sending all these chefs through their traditional 5-year apprenticeship or whatever it takes in Japan. And so he said, okay, I'm going to give them a crash course in this really intensive three-month training program. And of course, they still have a lot to learn after that. But at least that way they'll get the basics down, because his concern was exactly what you say, this question, you know, might the quality of the preparation degrade so much that people are going to start getting sick? So that was his answer to that question.
Sasha Essenberg, this is an email for you from Aaron in Mesa, Arizona. I'm a sushi addict. I've grown up on sushi, and my mom even claims that I teethed on octopus. However, I feel guilty about eating it on a regular basis due to overfishing and carbon emissions. How do we eat sushi responsibly? Is there a guilty-free way?
Well, I mean, I think that this is, I may differ with Trevor a bit on this one. I think that, especially as concerns the matters of overfishing, which are sort of the urgent concern to the long-term health of the wild stocks of some of these species, this is really a role where people have more to do as citizens than as consumers. And there's just this lack of information at the sushi bar. I mean, fish do not travel to a sushi bar with any sort of provenance. So the idea of being able to expect your chef to be able to decide, I'm going to buy this fish because it's sustainable and not buy this fish because it isn't sustainable, doesn't really recognize the complexity of these supply chains. And it's the problem with overfishing comes fundamentally from the fact that governments around the world are not as aggressive in enforcing treaties that they've signed and commitments that they've made, and are not aggressive enough going forward in pushing for new ones and following the science there. The fact is that, you know, that people, the United States, actually at this moment, it may be ironic for those who follow the climate change debate, let's say, where the United States has been fairly lax in following the Kyoto protocols. But when it comes to a lot of the international conventions on fishing, the United States has been very aggressive. It's European countries and Asian countries that often give a free pass to their boats that are ravaging fish stocks, and tuna is one of the major cases, and bluefin tuna is endangered. But political pressure will, I think, do far more than trying to exert the influence of the knowledgeable consumer at the sushi bar, because a consumer can only be so knowledgeable in the way that these supply chains have been structured.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Trevor Corson, I'll ask you the same question.
Well, yeah, I think Sasha's exactly right. I mean, one of the huge problems with seafood across the board is, how do you track it to its source? And this is a problem that everybody who's dealing with the sustainability issue with seafood is wrestling with. And I think there are a few glimmers of hope on the consumer end. There's an organization called the Marine Stewardship Council, which is looking at different fisheries and certifying fisheries as sustainable, and then packaging the products, you know, with a seal of approval. So you can start getting things like smoked salmon that are certified through that program. It's going to be a while before the types of fish that we're talking about for sushi can be certified in that way as well. My hope is that they will be, and there are a few pilot programs like hook, line, Cape Cod that are being caught. And I was at a sushi bar recently in Boston, where they were listing on the menu exactly which fishery their certain products on the menu were coming from. So, you know, I think both sides of this definitely need to go forward. We need the political pressure and the consumer pressure.
Trevor, there's an email for you from Jeff in Salt Lake City. I have a question about the sushi ingredient tamago. I know this is Japanese for chicken egg, and I've seen it described as omelet. Is there anything special about the presentation?
Oh, yes, indeed. And the students in my book, who I write about, learn how to make this. And it is actually one of the most difficult things to make in all of sushi. And in the old days, basically, if you were going to try out a new sushi bar in Japan, you would go and you would order the tamago first. And if it wasn't prepared up to snuff, you could feel justified in leaving without ordering anything else. Nowadays, most sushi bars get this stuff pre-made, you know, in some central facility somewhere. But the real old school places still make it themselves. And, you know, I describe the students trying to learn to do this in the book. And it takes a large number of eggs, indeed chicken eggs, and they mix in this incredible broth called dashi, which is used throughout Japanese cooking, made from a broth made from simmered kelp and molded dried fish flakes from skipjack tuna. And these are simmered to make a broth, and then the broth is mixed into the egg, and then the recipe varies a little bit depending on the place. But then the really hard part is that they have to use this special square pan, no nonstick here. This is all, like, you know, old school square metal pan, and create layer upon layer upon layer of this egg, and then flip it over in this increasingly elaborate and difficult flipping process using chopsticks and the weight of your hand and all this. And so it's so difficult that you can actually, it's it's considered okay to judge a sushi chef based not on his fish, but on his chicken egg.
That's like the poster child dish for don't try this at home.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And most of the students in the school, you know, were dismal failures at this for quite a while.
We are almost out of time, but Trevor Corson, I want to ask you what your favorite thing to eat at a sushi bar is.
Well, my favorite thing to do at a sushi bar is to have no clue whatsoever what I'm going to eat. I go in, and as I was saying, I try to establish a relationship with a chef, and I go in, and if by then he knows me, I sit down and I say, what do you got today? Surprise me.
Trevor Corson's book is The Zen of Fish. He's been here in Studio 3A. Thanks so much. And Sasha Issenberg, what's your favorite thing at a sushi bar?
I like hamachi, stuff from the yellowtail family.
Sasha Issenberg is the author of The Sushi Economy. He joined us from member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Coming up, spa treatments, creams, fancy mascaras. Sounds like vacation, but for Janet Carlson-Reed, beauty editor of Town & Country, it's work. We'll peek into her diary next. I'm Rebecca Roberts. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.